I'm Christopher Lydon with the poet and teacher, Rick Benjamin, who says the threshold instruction of most good poems is slow down, be alert, wake up. The reason to write a poem is to be of use, he says. The reason to read one is that it might change your life. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. In our series, Whose Words These Are, on the practice of poetry today, Rick Benjamin stands out as an activist, a communitarian, a Buddhist, a globalist, a family man who's always telling his own kids, remember, talk to strangers. He lives by Rumi's line from 13th century Persia, the breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you, don't go back to sleep. It's the idea that gets him up in the morning and animates his classes at Brown University and the Rhode Island School of Design on poetry in service to schools and the community. Rick Benjamin, locate yourself as a teacher, as a writer, as an advocate in the big scheme of poetry. Today, maybe of all time.
The first place I'd locate myself is in community with other poets, with other artists, with children, my own and others, with elders. I like to be out and circulating with poetry. And so I suppose the other context is that I think of poetry, which I derive from the 13th century, particularly as a wisdom medium, whether I'm in Japan or ancient Persia. Those are the antecedents that interest me and that drive me now in my work when I want to bring poetry elsewhere.
What got you in? Who told you you were a poet?
From a very early age, my mom, who was a frustrated writer, would read poetry out loud to my twin brother and to me when she was seeing us to sleep. And it didn't really matter if we understood it or not. In fact, mostly we didn't understand it. But I would hear, for instance, her reading T.S. Eliot, the opening lines of Jail for Proof Rock. Let us go then, you and I, while the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights and one-night cheap hotels. And I would hear that and think, well, that's beautiful.
The hand that rocks the cradle.
Yeah, yeah. She coped with being a mother that way. So she would read a lot of the times not what would interest us, but what would interest her and then by some process of osmosis get through. So for me, poetry comes through the ear always. And I'm sure it's that early experience of hearing her read.
What else did she read you?
Scary Russian folk tales, a lot of Yeats, Eliot, modernist poetry principally. So harder to understand poetry that we wouldn't understand so much as hear, like music.
Rick, you begin with Proof Rock. Are there other all-time poems that you will take with you forever?
Many. Poems by Langston Hughes were a staple in my family. We all grew up knowing them. More recently, poems by Lucille Clifton, Mary Oliver, Kevin Young, Alberto Rios. You know, I think of a posse of poets who've really informed me at different stages of my life. Robert Hayden, who's a poet and a great teacher. Robert Lax, who's nobody in this country has ever heard of, died in his late 80s 4 years ago on an island in Greece. Thought of by European poets as the best or one of the greatest American poets, but not so much in America. So many.
Give us a taste of those poets that mean the world to you and we probably don't know.
Sure. Beginning with Robert Lax, here's a very short poem and you have to kind of imagine it dripping down the poem like something skeletal because he hardly wanted to put a word on a line. Turning the jungle into a garden without disturbing a single flower. That's an example of a very simple Robert Lax poem. And the beauty of it, of course, is that the statement is so simple. It's got a certain rhythm, which I'm sure you heard. And the message, you know, the instruction is go light, walk softly, and do no harm, even in your most elegant transformations of a jungle into a garden.
How about Robert Hayden?
Sure. You know, Robert Hayden is important to me in many ways. I usually do his poems with elders when I'm working with them. So I work with foster grandparents sometimes in the summers. And a poem like Those Winter Sundays, you know, in which he finally pays tribute to a stepfather who was very difficult in his life, is one that comes to mind. Those Winter Sundays. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold, then with hands that still ached from labor in the weekday weather made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake to the sound of the cold splintering, cracking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him, who'd driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? And I think about that poem in relation to elders because the elders among us are probably the only ones who remember a father or someone else in their house getting up at the crack of dawn to load the furnace with coal. And then that heavy sound, you know, that you hear in the poem, Sundays too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. You can hear those rhythms, and it's the sound of the radiators coming alive, that pounding and that banging in the radiators that sounds like hammers. And also, of course, elders know what an office is, you know, an office where you don't have to contain yourself at work every day, but the office where someone does something for us, unremarked upon usually.
All of that delivered, I'm here to testify, without notes. What is that catalog of poetry in your head like?
Like bad music from the 70s. I have quite a store of that in my head too, I'm embarrassed to say, but poems tend to stick to me. And, you know, it is like being in the car with a radio because if I hear a hook that I like in a poem, then I'm going to want to learn the poem. And it's not about memorization for me. It's about wanting to say it and wanting to say it to the next person so that they might be able to hear it too, the way I'm hearing it.
You know, we keep discovering that poetry thrives in so many completely different and unexpected ways at a time when, you know, the publication of poetry is in danger and a lot of it's not taught in schools the way it used to be. Mm-hmm. Survey the scene. How's it doing? Where does it live?
I think poetry lives everywhere. You know, I find every single movement and gesture currently exciting. So, for instance, spoken word poetry, which I don't do so much, and with hip-hop and rap elements, interests me because it's an entry point. And if I get asked to go into schools all the time, and if a high school classroom is mostly invested in hip-hop poetry, great, I know some, and some good hip-hop poetry. I'll also want to take them from that perhaps back into the 19th century and introduce them to Gerard Manley Hopkins with his sprung rhythms and hyper-rhymed lines and see what they think of that. And almost always they're kind of surprised that somebody, you know, a Jesuit monk, was writing poetry like that in the 19th century, because it sounds to them like rap.
Give us a taste.
From Pied Beauty. Oh, glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color like a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim. You know, and I could go on, but actually just even that, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim. He could have just said rainbow trout, but the way he does it in that hyper-stressed, hyper-sounded way gives you this really bouncy quality of a fish in the water, jumpy. And so that sounds to me like some spoken word. Whether or not you understand, you don't have to know what the word brinded means, although it's fun. You know, once you're in a classroom and you've gone through some things and established some trust and built some relationships, you can pretty much do anything. So I'm kind of interested in it all. I like, you know, the contemporary scene. I think there's a lot of interesting things going on. I don't do all of them. I don't have to. But I love the range of offerings that are out there right now. And of course, I love, you know, everything from 13th century Japanese poetry to Spanish surrealism to spoken word. So, you know, I hope I don't discriminate too much.
People mention Hopkins for so many different reasons. Who are your other touchstones, American or otherwise, modern or ancient?
Emily Dickinson. Spanish surrealist poets like Machado, Juan Ramon Jimenez, Whitman, not in a way that I've ever emulated, but I like his spaciousness. And contemporary poets like Mary Oliver, Lucille Clifton, Shirley Giachlin Lim, and many, many others. Mm. I mentioned Langston Hughes already. He's definitely a touchstone poet for me.
I'd love to hear your own poetry, Rick Benjamin, in your own voice. Where do we begin?
These are more recent poems from my book, Passing Love, that's forthcoming. Growing Up. One part's abstract, listening to an underground river clearing its throat in the desert and thinking about the yucca, tapping their roots down to those drops. And the other part's a scene from a movie, waking up to a pale moon in half-morning light, feeling the tip of a knife at your throat, and just before hearing him say, "There's a scorpion on your neck. I'm going to flick it into the fire," thinking, "I guess this is it. He's finally going to do it." On one side of this is hearing the sharp sizzle of a scorpion in flames. On the other is the rest of your life. That poem's from Mojave Desert, where my family spent considerable amount of time when I was younger. Hmm. It's imaging the experience of growing up in a context which felt threatening and dangerous at times, and also required your ability to be aware and skillful in negotiating it in order to move past it.
Okay. Tell us about the American path of your own life.
Is profoundly familial and environmental. Hmm. So there's so many reference points growing up that have to do with my particular father or my particular mother, grandparents. You know, my grandmother helped raise me, for example. And at the same time, I think of it as also kind of almost geological and geographical in its intensity. So there are many poems which take place in the desert, any poems that take place in Los Angeles, in avocado groves that used to be there before houses were there, and hummingbirds and bees, things which were ubiquitous in places like Los Angeles and the desert and even the California Sierras where I spent time. And then later in Northern California. So, you know, the smell of wisteria, you know, as a sensual presence and palpable presence in my life. So that's how I would describe it, is that it's, for me, pretty visceral.
Mm. It sounds almost out of time as you describe it.
Mm-hmm.
In what sense are you a child of these times, and how would you describe them?
Well, first of all, I think that my artistic and spiritual practice is to trying to be as alert as possible to these times and to notice everything that's around me. So if there's a particular mix in my own work and also in the work of people whose work I admire, it's that they're paying attention all the time to what's going on around them. Could mean, you know, in the case of Mary Oliver, that you're taking a walk with your dogs and taking everything in. And that might be sort of an environmental focus or slant. With Lucille Clifton, you know, whose poetry might focus in particular in a city, more urban landscape, then she's paying attention to cities and what they're like and what the experience of people who grow up in them is like. My experience is also in growing up in a city. And so I try and pay attention that way. Providence for me is some version of Los Angeles, and I notice the resonances all the time. Lucille Clifton has a poem called – actually, it's untitled, but it starts out with the lines, "In the inner city," and so I think of it that way. But I think a lot about people – having done community work and heard people talk about urban blight and inner city squalor, I have to remind people sometimes that that's where people live, and that's where I lived growing up. And so when Lucille Clifton says, "In the inner city, or like we call it, home, we think about uptown and the silent nights and the houses straight as dead men and the pastel lights, and we hold on to our same someplace, happy to be alive, and in the inner city, or like we call it, home." Mm. There's a nice correction in there of where people live not being something that you should easily dismiss. People who live in the inner city actually, among other things, sometimes enjoy living there, like their neighbors, are strong as communities.
Please give us more out of your own new work.
Sure.
With introductions as you like.
Yep. I think this is pretty self-explanatory. I have already mentioned that I have twins. And so I have twins, and I also have a daughter who was born 13 months after them. So they all came around the same time. Before making love, they compare scars. For Margaret. At 49, he thinks he's got his share, holds up his right hand where, alone, he's got 10. She's traced the map of his forehead like a path that leads to some place she wants to go to, and the year a knife entered his hip is a time toward which she would travel. What he wants just now is not to think about the blows his body has taken, and as if on cue, she says, "Me? I've only got these two, the line beneath her navel where they lifted out twin sons, and the scar that is the same line deepened where their daughter rose up 13 months later. You got me, he says, as their skins start to knit together a path toward longing, their bodies already lost to the places where love has left its indelible marks.
Mm.
More in the love poem category.
Keep going. I'd love to hear more.
So this poem is a poem written to my twin brother. We went for 21 years without seeing each other, which is kind of a long story. And at that moment, I was visiting him in his apartment in Los Angeles, and he had a strawberry vine on his porch growing out of a pot. And he had saved the biggest, juiciest strawberry for me. And I connected it with some of my Buddhist practice in this poem called The Juice in It. Hmm. When the woman in the parable runs from the tigers to the cliff edge, she is simply jumping toward the saving vine. Only later does she notice the strawberries. When my twin brother hands me a ripe strawberry in California, he wants me to admire every bit of its sweetness before tossing it tongueward, which he knows I will not do. And that is why he is already disappointed. In the letter he writes weeks later, he says he knew I'd just pop it whole into my mouth without even thinking about it, juice dripping down my chin. Which is what she does in the parable when she knows she's going to die. Tigers on the cliff edge, tigers on the ground, and one mouse eating through the stem of the vine. What should she do but reach for the ripest strawberry she can find? He wants me to linger. I can already taste it.
Hmm. Rick Benjamin, describe the community of Rhode Island poets that you found and that you're building.
Some of the Rhode Island poets I care about most passionately are the students at Brown and at RISD, who circulate through my classes. We are trying to build a community of poets who go elsewhere with what they're learning. And so one thing that I try and emphasize in my work and in my own learning is making a kind of agile transfer from a learning community, which you can find in a classroom, to many elsewheres, and to make up for the fact, for instance, that there's so little poetry in schools right now. And in Providence Public Schools, very little in the way of arts education, because that's where the cuts happen first, and there have been such drastic cuts in those settings. So we make a commitment every single year to working with 500 to 750 others in our city, which is a modest amount, but significant nonetheless, and to planning lessons and to taking seriously that poetry is a wisdom medium and that we ought to, if that's true, pass it on to others. And so that's principally the community I think about first and foremost. There are a lot of, say, undergraduate poets you've never heard of. But that doesn't diminish their work in the least. They're accomplished poets. They're accomplished thinkers around community practice, and it means they're willing to move outside of this very privileged environment, and they feel privileged to be here and to work with others and who might need the same thing they need in their learning, whether they're 6 years old or 80.
Is the lineage or the light in Rhode Island poetry distinguishable from others in New England?
I think so. Galway Kinnell, you know, a great American poet, is from Pawtucket. He doesn't always talk about that because he's really thought of as a New York poet. But yes, I think Rhode Island poetry is distinguishable. C.D. Wright, Michael Harper, Forrest Gander, just to mention some poets who teach here, Mairead Byrne, who teaches at RISD and is a great Irish poet or Irish ancestry. And, you know, we're blessed to be around a lot of great poets in the state. Lisa Starr, who started the Block Island Poetry Festival and is the current poet laureate. There's a lot going on here all the time. And there's a, you know, a vibrant spoken word scene at places like AS220 and at New Urban Arts. And so I think it's really got a lot of range, and the work is pretty accomplished here.
Is the political moment that we're living through, however we define it, the age of Obama or the global moment of interest to you?
Absolutely. Yes. This past year, I don't have any of these poems with me, but this past year I was asked to contribute to an anthology of poetry called Haiku Year. It comes out every couple of years, and there's usually 6 to 8 of us who are contributors. And all of the poetry I wrote, we were asked to write haiku every month. So for me, that meant 15 to 20 haiku every month, and most of it was focused on the current political scene, I found. And I don't know if that's because the haiku is so much of a snapshot, and so it felt journalistic to me or what. But those poems are particularly tinged with the politics of the time.
I hope there's one or two in your head that would give us a snapshot.
No. The only haiku in my head belong to other people who were also looking at their time. So I'll offer up a few of those just because I can't offer up any of my own right this moment. From Issa. Don't worry, spider. I keep house casually. And you might say, well, that's not a political poem. But actually, the refrain from harm principle is extremely political. And leaving things alone is extremely political. And not getting involved where you don't belong is extremely political. So I would argue the other. And then another poem by Issa. New Year's Day. Everything is in blossom. I feel about average. So, you know, these cultural cues that we get all the time to enforce happiness and to feel it even when we perhaps don't. So you've got this seasonal marker. It's New Year's Day, not the same there as here. And this Japanese poet says, I still don't feel very good.
Rick Benjamin, I sent you to address your poetry to the times and the politics of your very specific and local community.
Yes. But also reference to the local in a global sensibility, I hope.
How does it come out?
Yeah, for example, I've been saying to my kids since they were little, whenever we would get in the car to go somewhere, to talk to strangers. It would be the last thing I'd say as we got out of the car. And remember, talk to strangers. Because I wanted to get underneath that idea that we should be afraid of them. And in saying that, the opposite thing, which I heard so often growing up, we're basically saying be afraid of the world. And so I wanted, first of all, to get underneath that fear, which I don't accept, and secondly, to give them a sense, to enculturate them, to see the world and the world's people as more welcoming and inviting than that. So that stands true in Providence. It also stands true in Palestine. And so after September 11th, I found myself saying this poem by Naomi Shihab Nye a lot because I wanted to get underneath what seemed like the villainy of Arabs suddenly, that they were being singled out as a group that we couldn't trust. And so since some of my ancestry is North African and Arab, I wanted to find a way of getting underneath that. And so this poem I found myself saying a lot, Red Brocade by Naomi Shihab Nye. The Arabs used to say, when a stranger appears at your door, feed him for 3 days before you ask who he is, where he's come from, where he's headed. That way, he'll have strength enough to answer, or by then, you'll be such good friends, you don't care. Let's go back to that. Rice? Pine nuts? Here, take the red brocade pillow. My child will serve water to your horse. No, I was not too busy when you came. I was not pretending to be busy. That's just the armor we put on to pretend we have a purpose in this world. I refuse to be claimed. Your plate is waiting. We will snip fresh mint into your tea. And that sense of invitation and welcoming, I feel it, have felt it all over the world from people who had nothing to give me. But I've been dragged into people's houses for tea. I've been served meals by people who barely had enough to serve themselves. And that generosity of spirit and that welcoming, I associate with my own family. That can't be more local, right? My grandmother, in all of the apartment complexes my grandparents lived in Los Angeles, was always the person who'd give you a meal. They never had anything. And so that sense of welcoming, that sense of invitation is something that we could talk about in a family, we could talk about in a community, or we could talk about and locate, you know, among Arabs, you know, which this poem does so beautifully. I probably should add that maybe the most political thing and that's overlooked in a poem like this is that some of the strangers are in us and that we need to offer a sense of invitation and welcoming to some of our own places with which we're unfamiliar or which seem to us strange or make us uncomfortable too. And that that gives us a much better chance to offer that kind of generosity elsewhere.
Beautiful. Rick Benjamin, there's something about you that embodies poetry, or am I nuts?
You know, if I aspire to be anything as an artist and as a father, as a community member walking around in this world, it's to become a good vessel and a good vehicle for whatever I have learned that could be useful to somebody else. And so to the extent that I'd like to be a good vehicle and vessel for poetry, absolutely, I'd like those seeds to be scattered everywhere and not just to be of benefit to me.
What is it you see yourself as embodying in some fashion?
Best moments, most fortunate moments. You know, you've somehow been able to tap into the wisdom of your ancestors. And it has nothing to do with you. You are not the agent of it. Toni Morrison says that she's not the one doing the writing. She's following it. She's following the voices that are speaking to her. Lucille Clifton says the same thing. I would like that to happen as often as possible and promise that I will never compromise or violate that sweet trust of being given access to states of mind that are more enlightened. And may I always do the right thing with whatever I find there.
You see, there's a sense in which you seem to carry it, even in your frame.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so.
If Robert Pinsky asked you to read for the Favorite Poem Project, what would yours be?
Wow, off the top of my head. Here's one, but I don't know if it's my favorite poem because I can't even pick my favorite last meal or favorite movie. I'm just going to say one that I know I like a lot.
Great.
And Robert Pinsky used to pick up his kid from my child care center in Berkeley, so this is kind of a funny question. So here's one by Mary Oliver called In Blackwater Woods. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tails of the cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the pond, and every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything in my entire lifetime leads back to this, the fire of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rick Benjamin, thank you, Mary Oliver. What is the talent that you'd most love to have and you don't yet?
I'd like to be a much better glass blower than I am. I dabble in it, but I'm very bad at it. I think I'm too interested in the medium to be good at it. Maybe that's paradoxical. But I like paying attention to it so much that when asked to do any of my own work, I'm kind of at a loss because I really like just watching. I'm kind of a glass-blowing voyeur. But something really colorful and liquid and fluid. And I should also mention that I think glass-blowing has taught me a lot about how to move with language.
Hmm. What's the keynote of your personality in your poetry, do you think?
You know, my book's called Passing Love for a Reason. It's the title of a Langston Hughes poem, but I think it would have to be something about circulating love unabashedly and without embarrassment. The love that we are lucky enough to find in structures like families, in our communities, between countries, that would be very lucky. And to honor it fully, creatures among us. You know, when I say something like refrain from harm and say that it's a political act, on a daily basis, it's a political act. I try not to kill mosquitoes. So that kind of love.
How do people perceive you when they notice you walking down the street? Who's that guy?
I don't know. Your audience can't see that I have a shaved head and that some of the time I'm wearing a beanie, so I might look kind of tough walking down the street. But my personality is kind of the opposite of that. I mean, I hope that I'm welcoming to strangers particularly, and that some of the warmth that I've been lucky enough to receive emanates from me as well. But I've been told that when I'm walking down the street in my boots and if I'm wearing black and my shaved head, that's not the first thing people notice.
When you think of fellow travelers out there in the world, artists in other mediums, who do you feel, alive or dead, as sort of carriers of your own spirit in their work?
That's such a good question. Visual artists like Andy Goldsworthy, who are willing to work with ordinary and organic materials and make something beautiful and impermanent and of the moment out of them. You know, that's all I aspire to as a writer, is to hopefully with fidelity make a snapshot of something and know that it will have changed and be gone tomorrow.
Stones in walls, like Andy Goldsworthy's, have something in common with words in poems, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, it's that elemental. I mean, to come back to Robert Lax, that poet who I said no American has ever heard of, you know, another poem of his I really love, and it couldn't be simpler, is just this, again, untitled. One stone, one stone, one stone, I lift one stone, one stone, I lift one stone. And I am thinking as I lift one stone. And there's no getting around the unremitting focus and concentration involved in Goldsworthy working with stones or creating an arch. And at the same time, it's dissolving even as he works. And so the kind of focus and willingness to lose everything that you're making at the same time, which also goes back to this whole thing about love, you know, to be willing to lose everything in any given moment. You know, I take that as one of the most important gestures that art can make.
Speaking of sort of doppelgangers, musicians, writers.
Yeah, musicians. Like poetry, I have a range of music that I really love. And so some of it is jazz and people like John Coltrane, for instance. And some of it is something more contemporary, like I listen a lot to the hip-hop music that my kids listen to. So Kanon, you know, is somebody they listen to right now. And one of his songs starts out positively Buddhist, it seems to me. Any man who knows a thing knows he knows not a damn thing at all. And that idea of beginner's mind resonates with me. And so I listen to everything. And while it's, again, really hard for me to say favorite this or favorite that, mostly, you know, it's a hook or it's a lyric or it's a strain of music that catches me and then I want to know just about everything I can about it.
Who's your favorite character in fiction?
You keep on asking me favorite, Chris, and I keep on telling you that I can't do it. My favorite character in fiction is probably the unnamed narrator in Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Because I like the fact that he wants to stay under the radar and somewhat anonymous. And I feel like I've carved out a similar direction in my own life. But it doesn't mean he's not working. He's being, as Robert Haas might say, delicately subversive.
That's great. What's your motto?
Motto. You know, I suppose it goes back to the last lines of that Mary Oliver poem. So if I have a motto, it's that I want to love as if my life depends on it. And when the time comes to let it go, I want to let it go. And beyond to the next thing. So that kind of alertness, you know, to know that I have an opportunity to love in every single moment and also that I might have the opportunity to lose all of it. And that we could call that something that we need to grieve over, but I see no reason to. It's just off to the next adventure in the next place. So I hope that I bring some of that alertness to my life and to my work, and I long to be unafraid of that other part, of letting it all go.
What's the quality, if you can reduce it down, that you look for in a poem? What's the quality that you most prize in a poem, your own or somebody else's?
Wisdom. Wisdom, and I have to say I mostly find it in other people's work rather than my own. So, for example, Rumi's poem Across the Doorsill. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are moving back and forth across the doorsill where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep. And I even love the beginning of that poem because for so many years, like most people, it didn't occur to me that the breeze at dawn had anything to tell me. And the idea that it does gets me up in the morning. Things that I haven't even thought have things to tell me are trying to tell me things all the time. And so I like that idea. So all I ask of a poem is that it has some wisdom. And then my job, I think, is to become a vehicle and a vessel and to circulate that wisdom if I have the possibility and opportunity to do so.
Rick Benjamin, thank you. And thanks to your mama, too, if I may say.
I will tell her you said so. Thanks, Chris.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Rick Benjamin at the Watson Institute. Our Brown University interns Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern are scouting and reading poets throughout this series, Whose Words These Are. Listeners, share a poem, suggest a poet, link to a score of conversations we've had with poets so far at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.